Recording.
Welcome to the First Fruits Podcast. We are your hosts. My name is Kristinia Ayala and Sichangu Lakota from the Rosebud Reservation, St. Francis Community. And
my name is Mary Opwam. I'm Nehiao Esquio from Sweetgrass First Nation, Sichuan.
Okay. And today our guest is, we'll allow him to introduce himself.
My name is Kamipawit Makwa, Standing Bear, Sotichot, Fishing Lake First Nation, Saskatchewan, Canada, Treaty 4 Territory, Anishinaabe, and I am honored to be here to sharing a little wisdom, a little bit of a story. So thank you for having me.
No problem. Tonight, our topic is going to be heart disease. And I know Wayne has quite a bit of knowledge to share. But before we get into that, I just wanted to say it's a big honor to have you here. And I do want to talk about the heart disease, but I also do want to hear a lot about your story. I know that you were a 60s survivor. And you've gone through a lot of trauma in your life, and you have managed to persevere through all of that. And I really feel like there's a lot of youth today that will benefit from hearing your story. So,
well, thank you very much. Yeah, thank you. It's an honor to be here. It's an honor to be anywhere. It's an honor to be alive. Honored to tell my story, especially the beautiful way you the way you brought it up. It's kind of like the pressure's on now. So anyway, yeah, I have a really, really interesting, colorful, as it would say, kind of backstory. And I'm a 60 scoop survivor. I was born Dwayne Ivan Smoke, Fishing Lake First Nation, Saskatchewan, Canada, Treaty 4, and on the day of my birth, the government came in and stole me from the arms of my mother, who was in a diabetic coma at the time, and placed me in an orphanage 800 miles away. And I can remember, then I aged up to foster care, and then I was later sold to a white family in the States, and my first people always ask me, well, what's your first memory? You know, my first memory was in a big room with a lot of beds, and it wasn't a pleasant memory. It was full of terror. It was full of fear. I was afraid all the time. I did not know what was going on. So I intuitively knew that what was happening was somehow wrong. But really, I really had nothing to base that off of, because I'm brand new here. So, remember going from house to house. I just remember not having any kind of home base, right? I just kind of remember that. And then one day there was these white people there, and they were looking at me, and I was looking at them, and I didn't know why they were looking at me. There were big smiles, and there I was, and what was happening at the time is that they were adopting me. They were adopting me. Actually, they bought me, and so off I went to the States, and grew up in what we say middle suburbia, Cherry Hill, New Jersey. So the first stop was my my father there was adoptive father was a professor at Penn State University, and then we moved to.
Yeah. Can I just ask you a quick question?
Sure.
When you say that they bought you, they literally bought you, like.
Well, they were selling kids. Yeah, so that was, you know, they called adoption, but it was really, you know,
was there an exchange of money?
There was an exchange of money. Yeah.
Wow. And that was from the Canadian government, I guess, right? Or
that was from, yeah. So.
Oh, wow.
Adoption, you know, agency. And so, yeah. So I grew up in New Jersey. It was the middle, you know, the early, actually in the mid 70s at this point. And this was, race was a big deal, especially back in the States. You know, they had a lot of race riots back in the 60s, all these social upheavals. And then, you know, there I was, the whitest kid in you know, this white, you know, suburbia type setting. And I can remember, you know, the kids, you know, kids my age, they would come up to me and be like, you know, what's, you know, why are you here? Who are you? What are you doing here? And, you know, I told them I was, you know, the only thing that I knew that I was some sort of Indian. That's it, you know. And I was born with a cleft palate. I had a lisp. They said I had learning disabled. They said, you know, going to school. Excuse me. They told me all this stuff. They said I was learning disabled, and I didn't know what that was. I definitely knew that I was born with a cleft palate. It was just, you know, just a mess. And I can remember thinking to myself at 7 years old, for being there for a little while, that I didn't want to be here anymore. You know, I would sit up late at night in my bed, and I would look out the window, and I could see all the moonlight. I could see the stars. I could see the wind. I could see all these things. And I knew there was some sort of God or something, there was some sort of thing out there, right? I knew it. I just intuitively knew it. And I wanted so much to be a part of that. I would cry myself to sleep every night, just crying. I said, you know what, God, if this is what you have for me, then I don't want it. I don't want to be here. I'm tired of life. I was 7 years old. And I can remember putting, you know, duct tape and scotch tape, and I would wrap it around my head, and I would sit there waiting to die. I would cover my mouth. I put, you know, stuff in my mouth. I would rag it up, and I just didn't want to be here anymore. But, you know, and of course I blame God. I blame God. You know, if God really loved me, God would have. This wouldn't be going the way it was. And I remember growing up also, you know, race was such a big deal. It really was. It was, you know, I can remember going home after school and just jumping in the shower and wanting to wash my skin white. And I would shampoo my hair until my hair was blonde. I literally would do this all night, and I was sitting showering, and none of it worked. None of it worked. I remember also that time, it was really, I packed this go bag, right? This thing, right? It was a little backpack. You know, built for toddlers, but I can remember packing it and repacking it a couple of times a day. And I was up obsessed over it. And what it had in it, it had a little windbreaker. It had a couple army men. It had a couple of bags of, you know, M&Ms. You know, had a chewable vitamins type thing, right? And I would check that over and over and over again. And I did this because if ever that car came, the government car came, and I knew it was coming. I knew that this car was going to come pick me up and then take me somewhere else, because I knew deep in my heart that I was unlovable, that nobody wanted me, nobody cared for me, nobody looked at me, I was the definition of not lovable. And I can remember thinking about, you know, why did my mom reject me? Why did my dad not want me around? Why did that? You know, and I can remember looking in the mirror. You know, I have a cleft palate, right? I have the cleft lip and the cleft palate, which simply means that it wasn't formed fully at birth, right? But I looked at that. I looked at that and I can understand, because every time I looked in the mirror, I'm ugly. I can't talk right. Can't learn. I can't read. Can't do all these things. And so I knew at the bottom of my heart, I knew that my mom rejected me. I wouldn't want to love me either, right? Who wants to love a little kid like that? Who wants to look at a little kid like that? Who's stuttering all day long, and I just knew it, you know. I just, you know. And, you know, the other thing was, too, you know, whenever I was going to school, you know, at that formative years, you know, the toddler years into 10 and then, you know, the kids at school, they would say that they were going home to their parents, or they had a mom, or they had a dad, or they had a brother. And I, for the longest time, I didn't know what they were talking about. Like, I knew there was a female, an older female at the house. I knew that. And I knew there was something there, and they called him a dad, but I didn't know how to relate to that. So they put me in, gave me a home, gave me a family, but it didn't tell me that's what it was. I had to figure that out on my own. Nobody said, this is your family now. This is, they will love you for the rest of your life. Nobody said that. So really, the terror of all of this, May mentioned this earlier, but the terror of all of this, I didn't think, you know, most days, the hope was I was going to fall asleep in the same bed I woke up in. That was the hope. But sometime during the day, I would look at the door, or a car would slow down, you know, in front of the house. And I said, okay, this is it. This is it. And I would look at that. And then I would go up, and then I would sit in my room, wait for the feet to come up the stairs, wait for the door to open, and then off I went. It was just, kind of skip ahead a little bit. It wasn't until I was 12 years old that I realized that I wasn't going anywhere. And tears running down my face. I had no idea how terrifying this was. I had no idea. It was just something. It was that daily terror. That those moments of absolute terror during the day, that these people, they may wake up one day and they may say, you know what, we don't want him anymore. Because that's what the world had taught me. I'm expendable. I'm unlovable, and I'm expendable. And if I do anything wrong, then that's just another trip out the door. You know, that's it. Right? You know. Yeah. So people ask me what it's like. Well, that's what it's like. You know, that's what it's like to wake up every morning and wondering if I'm going to fall asleep in the same bed. Wondering, you know, and the other thing, you know, my father, he was always my father, the only father that I knew at that time. You know, people would talk about, you know, their dads and their moms telling them that they love you, right? Oh, I love you. And I would kind of look and I'm like, who would say that? Just in the back of my mind. Because you know what? That guy sitting on the couch who I go home to every night, he never said that to me. Never said that to me once. Never said that to me. And so, And I figured somewhere in the back of my mind, I figured that if this was a family and I was staying, then that's something that they would probably say to me, right? But seeing that they're not saying to me, that I'm sort of alien, that I'm sort of like, I'm a guest, right? So growing up, I just felt like this guest in the house. You know, but the other thing too, you know, there was another thing, you know, growing up in care, you know, you see a lot of things at you feel a lot of things. I was pretty good at feeling out, you know, like if a person walked in the room, I would feel kind of like vibe them out. And I said, well, and you know, if you grow up in care, a new adult walks in the room and you're looking there and, you know, first thing that subconsciously and consciously and now it's conscious now that comes in your mind is okay, I am going to have to survive him or her. I don't know what him or her are going to do to me, and I don't know how often they're going to do it to me. But some way I'm going to have to survive them. That's the mindset, you know, making it to the next hour. You know, if I make it to the next hour, then I'll probably make it through the day. But if I don't, then that's it, right? You know, case closed, right? But there was a remarkable events that happened. But growing up, I was a pretty good athlete. You know, I'm big in stature now, right? Big in stature. I'm a big, you know, big shoulders, broad shoulders. And I was the same way as a kid. The same way as a kid. And so I was a really good athlete. Started this summer swimming program when I was 7 years old. Probably a couple months after I decided to fail, my first failed attempt at suicide. And this was a swimming program on a swim team, like an AAU 20, you know, year-round swimming team. And I talked my then dad. It was really the only thing that I can remember that I really wanted to do. And so I remember kind of looking at him and saying, yeah, I would really like to go swimming. And, you know, what a beautiful journey that was. I ended up being one of the best age group swimmers. There's like 8 and under, and then a 10 and under, and 12 and under, 14 under, yeah. And through every age group, I was consistently one of the best swimmers in the country. And I just don't know how that was. But, you know, but an interesting twist here. An interesting twist here is race, my lip, the way I spoke, my education levels really didn't seem to matter that much when I was winning. I was really big and really strong and really fast. And I won a lot of races. I won a lot of races. And so So I went from this little child of obscurity and clumsiness to some having some sort of stature in society. Whereas the kids, some of the kids at school, they were on my same swim team, and they said, "Hey, look, this kid can swim. He's really good." So, you know, again, I went from that, you know, they called me Button Lip growing up. Just saying, "Hey, Button Lip," you know, like that was my name, right? Because I had, you know, club pal and everything. So it went from Button Lip to Wayne. So winning, it humanized me. Humanized me in ways that probably saved my life. And on a more personal level.
What do you mean by that dehumanization saved your life?
Well, they didn't treat me like some sort of Button Lip Indian anymore. They treated me something else. They treated me like, "Oh, this Wayne, he's a really good swimmer." You know, they called me Eskimo actually growing up. So my swim team called me Eskimo, right? And so, like the Eskimos here, right? So it went from a hurtful to a playful type thing. That's what I'm meaning, right? I kind of found my place. Now my place in society, right? And society taught me that if you win, they will like you. If they win, they won't see your color. If you win, they won't see your lip. If you win, they won't look at your academic record, you know, type thing. So, the other thing on a personal level, there was, you know, when you feel unlovable, when you feel unwanted, you know, there's, you know, children do this self-blaming type thing, and I did it, and I said, "Yeah, I own that. That was my persona. I am unlovable. No one will ever love me here. I'm just stuck here." Well, and then begins that world, the self-talk world of how bad I was. What, just self-hate. All my talk was a self-hate kind, you know, but I took all that self-hate out in the swim pool. So it really helped my swimming. I mean, I was a really angry guy. I was a really angry little kid. I was a really angry, you know, young adult, you know, tween. And I was a really angry, teenager.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Were there any other Native kids in your class or in your school?
There was nobody.
And where was this again in the United States?
This was Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
No Natives at all, eh?
We were considered dirty. We were considered. Yeah. You know, there's that famous, you know, the only thing anybody knew about Natives was Thanksgiving, right? That's it. And, you know, we know the lie of, you know, Thanksgiving now. And, you know, the other thing, there was a commercial, a PSA about you know, the old Indian crying, you know, kind of looking over the highway and seeing all the trash. You remember that, right? And, you know, and people would be like, that kind of looks like you. And this guy's really like an Italian guy, right? So it's kind of like, and I'm looking at him like, but anyway.
If you don't mind my interjecting for a minute, Wayne, all I could think about with all the people in that school, how shallow they were, not to see the inner beauty of you, not to have compassion, you know, very, very shallow, which is pretty typical, I think, for people in their position, you know. But one day, it may have already come back on them. But yeah, that was the first thing I thought, oh my gosh, what shallow people, you know, there were.
that was, thank you. Yeah, no, thank you. And you know, and again, that's that culture, right? That's that culture. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't live the way of Earth, then that's who you become, right? Right. Yeah. We attach us.
I know in Canada, we didn't get Native people didn't get the right to vote until like 1963. Christinia, what year did they get the right to vote in the United States?
Yeah, it was around that same time, you know. Yeah. And even when we got to vote, our vote only equaled 1/3 of a person's vote. So three of us would have to vote to equal one person.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I know that. I don't know if you know too much about the history, even though you came from here as well, Wayne, that we weren't even allowed to leave the reserve until like 1963. And I always think
without
that,
papers.
I always think that it must have been such a horrible time to grow up in that era, and that would have been the era that you were following, hey, Wayne, because that was like the 70s.
That was right on the heels of that, right on the heels. And, you know, like, you know, let's talk about this for a second. The history of it. In the lower 48, we weren't allowed to practice our spiritual ways until 1978, Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
So during my early years, my formative early years, you know, that's probably a big reason why nobody was talking about it, because really nobody was allowed to talk about it. Even Natives weren't allowed to go to Sundance, Rain Dance, you know, sweat lodges, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I know our ceremonies underground here.
Absolutely. Right. That's what we did. We took them underground.
We had them, yeah. There's a story, yeah. I mean, I hear stories about that all the time. It just does my heart. But it's so good to see, you know, it's just incredible power when I think about
nothing
that,
can just kill the spirit. Nothing.
Nothing can kill the spirit. Well, yeah, you know, we are Earth. It can't kill Earth. So, I mean, you know.
I know.
We're part of that, right? So.
Yeah.
So I ended up. I ended up at this, my first rehab in my late teens, started drinking early. I started shooting heroin. I started, you know, everything, right, you know. And I started heroin just because this is what people do, not because I wanted it, not because I really, this is what people do when they hate themselves, right? This is what they do.
This was like, okay, because back up for a second there, you were just in high school, you were a champion swimmer, and then how did you end up doing heroin?
I was doing them side by side.
So were there other kids in school doing that too? Or how did you end up doing that?
It's easier to get, you know, I was going to high school in New Jersey in Hudstown at the time. Much easier to get alcohol, much easier to get any kind of dope. If you want a weapon, you can get a weapon. You can get into, you know, New Jersey's full of drugs. It's not hard, you know, pretty much on any corner, right? So I lived. This double life, this double, and coming out of high school, I was one of the blue chip swimmers coming out, like one of the best swimmers coming out on our high school team, Petty. We were like a 10th off the American record. That's how good we were. That's how good we were. As a high school team, I think we were placed third or fourth at NC2H. We had like three or four Olympians on our high school team. I wasn't one of them, but you know, that's how powerful that team was. And that's part of the opportunity that my father had you know, offered me. This is where I was supposed to go to Texas, Stanford, Harvard, you know, one of these top-notch schools. And literally a week later, I ended up rehab. I couldn't tell you which way was up, could not tell you anything about what happened. I've told this for a long time. I had torn my rotator cuff my senior year. Your rotator cuff, that's a major muscle group, part tendon, part of your shoulder. And you know, back then it was a death sentence. And so I had gotten this shoulder injury. And literally from one day to the next, the colleges that were interested in me, Georgia, Texas, you know, all these major swimming schools, Florida, you know, they stopped calling me. And then when the big swim meet happened at the end of the season, what did they do? I said, well, they shot me up with steroids. Put a huge needle, like this needle, in my shoulder. And I said, man, I'll just do anything at this point. I still ended up, couldn't swim for like 3 months, but ended up at that championship meet. And I still ended up being one of the best high school swimmers in the country after not swimming for 3 months. Right? That's how good. Imagine if I was swimming for 3 months. Like, you know, you're breaking American records here. But, you know, the fact was, you know, now my body was broken. I wasn't an academic. I was angry. You know, all those, you know, all these unhealed trauma things, they were beginning to surface. They were beginning to bubble over. So I literally would drink. And I ended up in rehab my senior year in high school. I did not graduate from Penny. I failed miserably. I was so lost, depressed, suicidal, lonely, scared. You see, that's what it looks like when these unhealed things bubble over. Like, they're asking me, what's wrong with you? I couldn't tell them because I didn't know. I didn't know that what happened to me in the Sipsis group, because now I'm in high school, and I had no idea that had anything to do with what I'm doing and how I'm doing it and who I'm doing it to. I had no idea. You know, they said to me that you should be absolutely happy. You know, we plucked you from shark infested waters, you know, whatever that is, you know, Indians, like every Indian is an alcoholic. Every Indian, you know, ends up violent, right? You know, and,
Wait, Wayne, can I ask you a question, honey?
Sure.
Was your adoptive father not aware of what was going on with you? How did it get that advance?
What do you mean? The drugs?
Yeah, with the alcohol and the drugs. I mean, did he not see what was going on and try to intervene
in
some way?
He was up in Boston, and I was in Hudson.
What about your mother? And what about your adoptive mother?
My mother, let's see, that was the early 90s. She was battling cancer at the time. They had colon cancer. I think she had her first round of chemo and all that. So, you know, they were preoccupied doing that. And I just kind of did my thing. Like, they were hoping that, you know, Georgia, Stanford were going to give me a huge swimming scholarship. And then, you know, that was the hope. But, you know, in the end, I ended up at this place called Beach Hill, New Hampshire rehab. It was, I was in their juvenile facility, right? So,
how did you end up there? Because who became aware of your issues? Your issues with drugs
and alcohol.
I think
they found me like doped up or found me on the floor at some point. I can't quite remember.
Yeah.
It was a little hazy. They asked me what. They may have found some paraphernalia. There were some rumors going around anyway around campus about, you know, what I'm doing. I'm like, And I'm literally off the chain. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how. I did not think that I was going to live one more year. And that started about age 7. Like, there's no way that I'm going to make it to 8. There's no way. Like in my little childhood mind, that's the mentality. And so really, at some point, if you know you're not going to make it till next year, then it doesn't matter. My life doesn't matter anyway. Because remember, I'm still unlovable. Nobody will love me. No girl will ever look at me. No one, you know, look at my lip, you know, just like, you know, look at this really sad sack that I am, that my life has become, right? Aside from all this, you know, the notoriety, and, you know, like the interviews and you know, of Swimming World magazine and being on the cover and you know, being almost breaking that American record in that relay, and it was just all this. Behind all that, there was a broken little boy that came up broken.
Yeah.
Well, it's really sad because
I can remember, and I'm not sure if I've really ever told anybody this, but you know, there was some suicide attempts, you know, mixed in there, right? There were some suicide attempts, right? And, you know, again, we're in New Jersey, you know, it's like gag central of the freaking world, you know, maybe out of, you know, except maybe Miami, Central America, but, you know, you can get a weapon. You can get a weapon really easily, you know. And I'd gotten one. I put that thing in my mouth. I pulled the trigger, and it did not budge. It did not budge. So this was repeated suicide attempts. So one thing that I'm a failure in life. I'm a failure because I'm doing this. I'm a failure because I'm so sad. I'm a failure because I failed out of, you know, high school. I'm a failure because I can't even kill myself anymore. So it was just lumped in to just imagine where I was, right? Just imagine. You know, and that's just the way life was. That was it. Nobody asked me. I don't ever remember until my elder in my early 20s asking me, what happened to you? Nobody ever asked me that before. I was diagnosed, huh?
What was your elder's name again?
I know Tony Stonehawk. Tony Stonehawk. He's still my elder.
By the time you met Tony, how many times were you in and out of jail at that point?
In and out of jail? Oh. There.
Mentioned you had been to jail quite a few times when you were
injured. I've been I have to look at that, but you know, there was a series of institutions and, you know, rehabs and, you know, stuff like that, right? It was a series of them all written down, yeah, somewhere, but it was really, yeah, moving on.
Wait, Mary, could we take a quick break? Didn't you say you wanted to take a series of breaks to see how, if it was uploading?
We can take because a break.
Because I really have to go to the restroom as well.
Oh, no worries.
Okay. Okay.
We'll okay.
And we're back. So, you know, growing up, did not know yet, make this very clear, I did not know yet anything about this thing called the 60s group. I just assumed naturally that my mom rejected me, my tribe rejected me, my heritage, like, you know, it's tough growing up thinking that your whole nation, your whole tribe just rejected you. And that was just a falsehood that I just made up myself, but it was logical to me to that, saying, well, you know, my mother rejected me, you know, it's probably the whole tribe did too, because, you know, like, who wants to look at me? Like, who wants to look at this, like ugly kid, right? You know, and so I'm like, yeah, so feeling, you know, carrying this, you know, it's really, yeah, it's really, you know, I just, and, you know, the suffering yeah. was alone. The suffering yeah. was at night.
Well, I was just going to say that I really, really identify strongly with what you're talking about, because, you know, my parents were divorced when I was probably about 3.5 years old. And that's when hell on earth began for me, you know, because my father was busy building a business. My mother was busy looking for her next husband. And so my sister and I were abandoned a lot. We were left alone to fend for ourselves. A lot of times we were left and there was no food in the house. So we would wander the streets trying to find food. Anybody, you know, and one time I said, oh, do you smell that good smell? So we followed the smell and it was the fire department. And we said, whoa, that really smells good. What are you going to eat? And they said, hot dogs. Would you like some? So we went down and they fed us. The next night we showed up again and they said, well, where are your parents? Don't you need to be home for dinner? And we said, no, we don't know where our parents are, which was a mistake, because then we got taken into foster care and we were in foster care for some time. And so I can really identify with what you're saying, because, you know, my first rape was when I was about 4 years old. And then it was sexual abuse and exploitation until I was 9, and we moved to Colorado from Wyoming. And so I can identify with the pain, with the feeling. You know, my mother used to tell me I was ugly because I was brown. I looked very Indian, and my sister could pass for white. And so my mother said, if you can pass for white, do it. I knew then there was no hope for me. You know, there was no way I was going to pass. And, but anyway, so then, you know, that's when all that the sexual, mental, emotional, physical, spiritual abuse started. And, you know, the abandonment issues, I still, you know, I find myself every now and then still having to deal with them to this day. And I started my healing journey when I was 25. But I think I said that to say this: I've had a broken heart most of my life. Because of the abandonment, because never hearing anybody say to me, I was a precious, lovable child. What I was to my mother was an ugly child who couldn't pass for white, you know. And I think she said that to us. I like to believe that she said that to protect us, but that meant she was protecting my brother and my sister, because both of them could pass for white. My youngest brother, my baby brother, and I couldn't. We're very brown and very Indian looking. And so I've had a broken heart most of my life. And I ended up in 2014, I found my path. I found my red road. I was doing a lot of healing, but I ended up having to have open heart surgery. I had to have a triple bypass. I was on life support for 2 days. And it was a very frightening time for my children, because it was emergency surgery. So I was in ER one day to see what was going on, and transferred in an ambulance to the Medical Center of the Rockies, an excellent heart place to have heart surgery if you ever have to have it. And I know you have a similar story, and I want to know, can you identify with that broken heart syndrome possibly Absolutely. Leading to heart disease, besides having a poor diet when we were little?
You know, absolutely. And I was about to say, this is, this is a heart story. I think we all have heart stories.
Yeah.
This happens to be my heart story, and you hit it right on the head when you said broken heart, and I had a broken heart since day one.
Yeah.
And you know, we try to explain this. Not a lot of people understand. you know, they call me a professional victim and they did all this, but you know, the stories, our stories have to be told, because our stories are you know, beautiful medicine for those who are, you know, helping through. And, you know, my story is, I have congestive heart failure. I have heart disease. I've had 3 major heart attacks as a pretty young man, right? First at 42, 45, you know, whatever it is, right? You know, and so, and that just hoping to get a few more years in here, right? You know, if I do, that's good. If I don't, it's been a good journey, right? Getting through, there's no rhyme or reason. Got through, just through the physical abuse, the emotional abuse, and the suicide attempts, the rehabs, the relapses, there's a reason why, we're sitting here, right? And it's probably to tell our story in a good
absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely. And to let people know that we've been through hell, walked through the flames of hell, and what it did, it forged us into being stronger. And it's because of the red road that we both found, Wayne, I think I was probably 68 or so. I'm 76 now. Yeah. So it was during that time that, you have to face the possibility that you may not make it much longer, So I faced that with the help of the Red Road, the healing ceremonies that we have. Yeah. I went, I've been through the calling back the spirit ceremony of the Lakotas. And because every time we go through that kind of trauma, our spirit leaves our body. I felt mine leave my body when I was being raped. And I would remember thinking, you may be able to take my body, but you can't take my spirit. You can't touch my spirit. But when your spirit returns to your body after the trauma, it never returns wholly, completely. And it wasn't until I truly started my working even harder after, on the Red Road that I had the calling back the spirit ceremony. And I'm telling you, after that, I went through that, I felt whole. I felt complete, like I'd never felt before in my life. And so you and I we've walked parallel on our journeys. And I wanted to share that with you. Yeah. So I know your story so well, sweetheart. I do.
Yeah, thank you.
And here we are. And here we are. What?
That kind of leads into like your next area of your, like, I know you have a very long, very beautiful Wayne. But I know when we were talking previously, you had mentioned that you were going through a lot of heart issues when you were still living in the States, and part of your healing journey was coming home. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that played out?
I've never really had roots, right? I've never had roots, and for whatever reasons, we can look at psychological and emotional reasons, but, one of those things that I've never really had in my life is one healthy relationship. And the Red Road has helped me have a healthy relationship with the first person I really need to have a healthy relationship with. It's me, right? It's me, and that began really walking the Red Road and understanding and layers and layers of healing, and in thousands of quite a lot of ceremonies and all that beautiful thing. But my story is, and this is where it's significant, I think, for others to really understand, is that I was in the hospital almost every other month. Every other month because of health issues. And I can remember, and I was in the States at the time. And I can remember calling, I've been lucky enough to have a couple grandmothers, my circle, my inner circle, right? There's like, there's the friends and there's acquaintances and there's people you kind of say hi to, across the street, but then you're like the inner circle is where the real healing happens, right? So, Grandpa Tony, maybe a handful of others are on that list. And on that list was this grandmother that you will die if you don't come back to your ancestral. I know. I don't really talk about this enough, right? It's, one of those things, right? I and it sounded reasonable and it sounded spiritual and it sounded responsible, right? But there was a little part of me that always said that you will always be rejected. Because that's just life. Wayne shows up, that's just it, right? I understand that I carry, a lot of sickness when I was sick, but now that I'm healthy and, walking the red room, there's a lot of other positive things, but still one of those lingering things that I really needed was to go home, and really the fear was that if I went home, I wasn't going to be welcome as one of the tribal members, right? Because I just carry different medicine than Soto. I just do. It's very similar, very, very similar, right? But it's just not Soto.
Did you understand at that point what happened with the 60 scoop? Like, at what point did you realize that you were basically legally kidnapped and sold?
That's a great question. What spurred that was my mother had succumbed to, my white mother, my adopted mother, had succumbed to cancer back in November 97. And I went back to her funeral, and she was just a shrivel, just awful looking, right? And I talk about this a lot, that being one of the most pivotal days of my life, because her last lesson to me was showing me what mourning really
was. Right? Was
what grieving and mourning really was. And the fact was, I had been grieving and mourning my life, not even known about it, had no relationship to it, was feeling it, what was had me by the short hairs, didn't even know, even walking the red road for all those years, right, all those years before, coming into contact for the first time with Mother Earth, the fire, the water, and all that. So that day I realized I didn't lose one mother, I lost two. And whatever relationship that I had, it was, how dare you, creator, whatever it is, God, I think we're still calling God, how dare you do this again to me, but anyway, that conversation turned into, well, maybe she's out there. And then it turned into, well, maybe I should look for it. And then I started to look for it. And then 6 years later, and this has to be noted too, 6 years later, I had three names and three numbers on one sheet of paper of the name of my mother. And this is back when we had house phones. You may be I don't know if you remember house phones, but I put this right by the house phone, and I can remember I walked by it for a year, calling what was my Nuanya. And the fact was that rejection, I couldn't handle that again. Just couldn't. I just couldn't. I couldn't talk to my wife then spouse about it. I couldn't do it. I said, but I knew what I could do, and that's what really scared me. I would put a pistol in my mouth again and pull the trigger, and that's what I would do. If I called up, and my mother said, you know what, you were just a one night stand. That guy was an a-hole, and oh, sorry, that guy was, that guy was this and that, and I just don't want you anymore. It's better off you just stay away. I don't love you. I couldn't handle that. I could not handle that. So anyway, one night I found this private investigator online, and she happened to run a Canadian. And what happened was, I would go through these adoption reunion sites, back in the day, right? And how, a large percentage of them didn't work out. But I would still keep looking, like picking at a wound, right? I would still just kind of look and pick at it. And then I came across this adoption website. I'm like, Canadian adoption website. And I'm like, I don't know what this is about. And then it started talking about Indigenous adoption. And I'm like, Canadian Indigenous. And then it started talking about this thing called the 60s group. And I'm like, and then there was that slight bit of, hope, right? That's like, well, maybe this could be it possibly, right? And so I contacted that woman that night that ran. She was a private investigator, Ann Patterson. Remember her name? And I contacted her that night through email. 5 minutes after I hit the send button, she responds, and it sounds like you are a 60s group. And I'm like, and so she said we would call the next day. We called the next day, explained the whole thing. I gave her the three names and three numbers, and I said, this is going to save my life. If my mom is the right mom, but she says, no, don't want anything to do with him at this point. No. Lie to me. Just tell me. Tell me, I'm going to tell you what to say. This wasn't it. She wasn't the right person, whatever it is. And I will believe the lie because I believe more that this was going to be the final rejection of me, the final rejection. And, there's only so much a heart can take. There's only so much a man can, it really is. At that point, I just had enough, man. I'm through with this. I'm done with this. So anyway, she called up the next day, said, I have just spoken to the most wonderful woman I've ever spoken to. And then just decades of tears just coming out. And there was, she loved me. That was the first time I have ever felt loved in my entire life.
Paul, was that your mom that called you? Or the private investigator?
That was the private investigator that called, the three names and the three numbers they were going to call the next day. And so the private investigator called the three numbers the next day, and then she called me right after and said that the private investigator called me and said that this is the most wonderful woman I had ever spoken to. And so it was just kind of like, that new opening. I was so excited to hear. It's nice to be remembered. It's nice to be remembered and loved. And you know what? They had a birthday for me every year.
That's so unreal that actually happened. And, because like listening to it, it sounds like, crazy fiction that would not be happening, but this like actually happened to people. It's crazy.
And within the next couple months, I was up on a plane and I was going to Canada. And then I was on my ancestral grounds.
And it going was back warm. To the beginning.
Yeah. Huh?
That you were going back to the beginning, back to the place where it all started.
Yeah.
You had to go back to the beginning to find the healing.
You know, let me tell another quick story about the homeland and you know, art. And I've been going back there. I made contact with my mom's side of the family and, you know, five brothers and sisters. And it was beautiful. And you know, just walking. I would just walk on the land. Excuse me, but there was this one part I still didn't feel like I was recognized by the people in the tribe, right? We're just like, they were just like, I dress different, I sound different. I sound like an American, right? You know, I don't have the old, you know, prairie draw, right? I just don't have it, right? So, and I dress different. I'm lived in Miami for a long time, just like, you know, blending, you know. And
Saskatchewan's a pretty small place, and that's where you went, hey? You went back to Saskatchewan?
Treaty 4, yes. Fishing Lake First Nation. That's where I was, right?
Yeah. You know,
right in the middle of middle of the prairie, right? You know, we're just kind of like...
We don't meet a lot of people from California down there.
there's not a lot of people, you know, down there. And so... you know, I felt like an outsider. Some people said some things and made me feel like, well, you're not really from here. Well, yeah, you're not really from here, though, kind of thing. And I'm hypersensitive when it comes to that. I know I am. Big wounds means, you know, hypersensitivity, right? You know, one thing you learn along the way, right? You know, I said, oh, yeah, okay. You know, when I'm feeling hurt and wounded, that's when I'm hypersensitive, right? So anyway, I wanted to know, I needed to, and this is a heart medicine story, heart medicine. And so wanted to know if the ancestors, my ancestors, recognized me as one of them. Because I wasn't hearing a lot of it. Right. And so when summer, I've been all there summer. It's pretty recent, back in 19, right? So this is where the healing comes in, right? I would go down there and I would make a little prayer bundle. And I would make a little dish of food. And I would sneak out of my mom's house and I would go down there a couple of times a day. The prayer grounds are just, you know, 150 yards away, right? So I would sneak in there, you know, the prayer ties on the trees and stuff. And then I bought some, you know, learned how to do it from you know, my elders to know how to do this. And I got permission to say, okay, so now I'm doing this, right? So, and my prayer was, do the ancestors of who I am, do they love me? You know, again, I wasn't as dramatic as putting a pistol in my mouth again. I wasn't that dramatic, but I'm like, you know, I just really need to know. I want to know. I have to know if my ancestry loves me, respects me, honors me, you know, powerful Indian stuff, right? So I've been doing this all summer. You know, leaving offerings, leaving, you know, tobacco and sitting there, tears running down my almost every day, just like, oh, I just want to know if you did, you know, tears, you know. So I got my routine. I'm doing it now, right? I'm in the middle of it, right? I'm in the middle of this, Jim. You know, I could hear riders on horseback coming. You know how the ground shakes, you know, you see the riders coming, right? And you know, like they weren't too far, they're about maybe a half mile away, but you know, but I could hear, don't break your prayer. So I'm saying, I'm not going to break my prayer. not going to break my prayer until it's over. And it got louder, and I could hear the of the horses. It was getting louder and louder. And you know, I kind of peeked over. The trees were just kind of like shaking. It was like probably four or five, maybe six riders, right, coming, you know, riding hard, right? Not that uncommon to see that, right? So riding hard, riding. I'm sitting there praying. I'm praying. They came up right to me. They were right behind me. They stopped. I could hear them. I could hear the horses neighing, you know, neighing. I'm not going to break my prayer, though. I'm not going to break my prayer. My prayer finished, and I turned around. And then I heard, "You will always be one of us, always be one of me." Only just tears, you know. I can't make this stuff up. I cannot make. And I heard it. "You are welcome here. You will always be welcome here. And if you want to talk about a heart healing moment, that was one of the, and I still think about that. I still pray to those very ancestors that came up to me that day. Or, you are one of us. Even if that world, not the treaty, not my tribe, but even if the other world says you're not part of us, I know that there's a place called home. I know it, like I know it, like I know it. And still, you know, still kind of, you know, I'm still thinking about, well, do I really fit in there, right? I still have that, right? There's still a part of me that's broken, right? But now I'm broken here, and I'm healing here, and I'm healing on my ancestral land, and I could not do that sitting in Florida. Doesn't matter how many books I wrote or, you know, the fame, it doesn't matter. I need to sit here on Treaty 4 land. I need to sit with the ancestors. I need to let them know that I'm here, that I'm back, that I need some healing. That I'm here.
And how is it today? Like, I know you said that once you came back to Saskatchewan, you started having a less health problems and stuff like that.
It's really getting back. If we're talking about the heart medicine, it's really getting back to the lineage, the land, and really connecting with those that have offered us life. And it's really about, mm-hmm. you know, that they still give us life, you know, and that's something that we don't think about or talk about or honor, especially in that honor colonial circles. They don't talk about the power of the prayers and the power of the ancestors.
They don't. Yeah.
I'm still here.
Yeah,
can you hear me?
We heard you.
Okay. We were all right.
About the power of the ancestors.
The
so,
power.
Wayne, I know you guys are your people in Saskatchewan. They're and I'm.
Yeah, we couldn't hear you.
But.
Okay. Just wait.
We couldn't hear you.
Okay.
Hold up, we gotta start again.
Okay, all right.
So we're back from our break, Wayne, and I know you were just talking about when the spirits had come and let you know that you were right where you were supposed to be. I know that the territory that you come from, those are Soto people, right?
Yep.
And I'm Cree, Saskatchewan as well. And I know that the Cree are matrilineal, so that means that where my mother is from is where I'm from. So yeah. I definitely believe you're definitely with your people. I'm not sure if you guys are matrilineal as well. But I'm pretty sure most tribes are.
Yeah.
How is it for you now over there? Are people more
it's still, I'm still going through that process about being feeling like really truly feeling being a part of truly feeling being accepted. What the heart, again, we're talking about heart medicine, right? So what I'm doing now is what my elder grandfather Tony, who's Nanticoke out of Delaware. He said, Jack, can you hear me? He said, keep helping. Just keep helping the people, right? Keep writing the books, keep doing this. And, what I've added to that too is, because of, what happens to the Indigenous women, I'm starting a nonprofit to help the missing and murdered Indigenous, all Indigenous missing and murdered, really, really helping, trying to help my people. Feel safe, feel loved, and feeling secure. All those things that, because it's not just the Indigenous women that disappear. There's loved ones, there's fathers, there's brothers, there's uncles, there's grandfathers that miss them. That's part of that conversation. So what I'm doing it's heart therapy. It's really, creating this nonprofit to assist in helping my Indigenous sisters.
That's good stuff. That's awesome. Well, they're very lucky to have someone like you on their team, Wayne.
Yeah.
And the work, you definitely have all the experience to be able to. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it just, it's, it's one of those things about holding on to, holding on to those prayers, that's it. Everything begins with the spirit. If it doesn't begin with a prayer, then it doesn't begin, And really, my whole life is dependent that I walk with that prayer. If I stray from that prayer, then you get what you get. And at this stage of the game, I don't, it's a dice roll to see what really come up, because I've had three major heart attacks. I don't know if I'm going to live through another, right? So I might as well make these prayers count for as long as I'm here, right?
Yeah, for sure. So basically, when you came back from Saskatchewan, or came back to Saskatchewan from the States, you've had, and reconnecting with your mother's land and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You haven't had as much heart issues, hey?
No, not really. No, not really. So, had one little bump there. I was in the maybe for a day or two. There were my blood sugar. So everything's kind of leveling out right now. Everything.
Are you diabetic?
I am, yeah.
Oh, you are.
So, yeah.
How long have you been diabetic?
I think full blown, maybe 2 or 3 years. I was pre-diabetic for a long time.
Oh,
and,
uh-huh.
Yeah, and now, that's the next stage of my development. It's really, really understanding and sitting with, the medicines, right? really, you know, really the earth medicine. So I really want to gravitate towards, you know, healthy earth medicine and rather healthy pharmaceutical medicines, even though pharmaceuticals, you know, they have their place in the circle, right? They have their, you know, healthy, you know, it was practical, it's spiritual, as my elder would say. If it's practical, you take heart medication, you take your heart medication, right? You know? So, yeah, but continues, but he said, still go with, work with, you know, the natural herbal, you know, remedies. So, you know, I'm exploring that. So
I would strongly suggest that, that you stay away from Western medicine as much as you can. I was raised in a family where we didn't go to the doctor. You know, I was told to stay away, as far away from Western medicine as I possibly can, because all Americans are human guinea pigs, you know, for big pharma. And, diet modification, physical exercise, meditation, those kinds of things, and practicing the Red Road as much as you do. Those are, you know, those are all the best healers there. But don't make me worry about you, Wayne. You start modifying your diet now. I know you can do it.
It's much less of a cookie diet now and pizza diet.
Busloads of cookies, you say? That's a lot of cookies.
That's funny you say all that. That's funny you say all that, Kristinia.
What's that?
That's funny you say all that, Kristinia. But yeah, anyways, Wayne, why don't you tell us about some of the stuff that you're doing now. Like, I know that you mentioned you're doing a trip, you've written books. Many things. Like, and how many years have you been walking the Red Road?
I've been walking. Yeah, thank you for that. So I've been walking the Red Road, I think we figured it out the other day, 27 years. So back in my early 20s, I sat down with was my elder. Actually, I didn't know who he was. He was just a guy, right? So he, and anyway, Tony Stonehawk. And so been walking with him, you know, sitting with him. And now, you know, the Red Road is the road of wellness, right? The road of wellness, you know, life returns. And so slowly over time, my life is shaping up and returning and being thoughtful and all these beautiful things. Like if I wrote a list of everything that I wanted when I started the Red Road, I would have sold myself out, man. Really would, because the first thing would have been sobriety, right? I just want to get one day sober, man. That's all I want, right? You know, but in actuality now, I have written my third book is coming out in Paris this April. It's my autobiography. And I've written three more meditation books. I'm just waiting to publish them. So I do art. I do music. I lecture around the world. So it's just, you know, I do a morning meditation, just, you know, it's part of what I do anyway, right? It's just part of
You're
what I do.
You're also cathartic, right? To get rid of all of that pain and to be able to say, I survived it, you know, and let me take your hand and help you survive through anything that you're going through. I applaud you. I applaud you, brother.
Thank you. Thank you. Is you know, it just you know, this is just a beautiful, the ways of Earth, and you know, I'll keep sticking to the ways of Earth, you know, and that really seems to be where the beauty and the majesty and simplicity really is, you know. Like if I want to volunteer for like all that chaos, I'll leave the Red Road and I'll go back to the colonial world, and I'll be like, what is going on here, man? Left and right, up and down, you know, political this, political that, you know, they get to label me all over again, right? You know,
yeah.
I think I'll stay away from those labels today. I think
I know. I mean, who I think wants it's better to go for my heart again? Yeah,
I think it's better for my heart. Just no.
Yeah.
Wayne was during saying, one of our on the break, Christina, Wayne was saying that if we happen to be in Paris when his book is being released, that we can join him there.
You can join him in. Oh. Yeah.
Let me know when.
I think it's University of Paris or Paris University is the one that they're working with a nonprofit. And what happened was they're picking four indigenous stories throughout the world.
Oh, wow.
And they picked mine, and I think all those four people, they have all written autobiographies, and they will all be there that night. And the beautiful thing is, we are making plans to all sit in a healing circle together.
That's amazing.
That's pretty exciting. Yeah. So we have someone from Africa. We have another one from Central America. So it's just like, and we're going to get to sit and, we'll get to do some prayers together. I think that's really, really. So the offer's open. So, if you happen to be, I don't know, in Paris.
I'm a prairie girl. I don't leave the prairies. Maybe Christina seems to get around a lot. So maybe she'll show up there.
Well, she's going to New York. So
yeah, she's all over the place too. Was just in New York.
So
you do the healing, you do the online circle every day. You're an author, all these amazing things. Well, thank you so much for coming and speaking with me and Chris. Thank you for having me.
Happy to jump on again.
I keep not noticing that I'm on mute, but I just wanted to ask you one quick question or mention this again. You mentioned Dr. Gabor Mate, and, I love what he talks about, him and Maria Yellow Horse Braveheart and Paul K. Chappelle. I mentioned that they all have these different stories, but the bottom line of all three of them is the same. All of our heartache, all of our pain begins with the dysfunctional childhood, which is created by the United States government, by the Catholic Church. When they put us on reservations, they massacred us. When the Catholic Church beat, tortured, raped, and killed our ancestors, that's where it comes from. And so that's the story of historical trauma, historical grieving, which you and I have gone through, and we know how painful that can be, to finally historical healing from that trauma. And it's taken a lot of hard work, but I admire, that you and I have walked through that, and I love to hear your story. And I'm so grateful to you. I'm so grateful to you for being so open and honest and forthright and willing to show your heart.
Thank you. At the end of the day, that's the healing right there, when we get to find, feel, show our heart, show our truth. The old one said, you have to go to your truth to find that healing. And my truth was pretty ugly sometimes, right? But it's just,
Well, thank you.
It's a story of perseverance for sure. And I'm sure that there's a lot of young indigenous people that will benefit from hearing that. So thank you so much, Wayne. Definitely an honor. Such an honor to have you here. Thank you for spending all this time with us.
You are so welcome. Again, thank you for having me. And let's do this again sometime. Thank you.
All right. What I would like to do at this moment in time, if you don't mind, I'd like to take time to thank our sponsors at the Mellon Foundation and Urban Indian Health for making this season of the First Foods program possible. And so honored that Our first guest was
Thank you.
Wayne.
Thank you.
Kilo
Thank you
Maya.
so much for having me.
Aye, aye.
Mit video, yes. Yeah.